$155 million wonderland. As if by magic, 1,216 acres of wasteland have been transformed into the most stupendous exposition the world has ever known.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness the most excitingly different new concept in the history of television.
So you see, folks, all of you who are living in the year 2000 are fortunate.
I think it was back in 1944, wasn't it, Mother?
That's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen.
So you literally waited until you're 20 to see The Godfather Part 1 and 2.
Yes, which, I should be in confession here, I guess. So
didn't help Mike. Won't help you.
It's, yeah,
he's still going straight to hell and he knows it.
They tried to keep him pure. Poor guy just got sucked in. it was always a movie I kind of put off. It was like this great, you know, some great adventure I'll go on one day. And yeah, I just never did. I never sat down with it, but I finally did. And I mean, the trick with a movie like that is what? That you've heard all these things, you've been through the classes, you've read the books, and everyone talks about Godfather. They talk about it on sports radio, like it's everywhere.
Yeah, all the time.
And so you see it, it's set up for a letdown now because it's a 50-year-old movie, but it's fantastic. If you haven't seen it.
Yeah, but you sound like a girlfriend that doesn't want roses on her Valentine's Day or something like that. Or like, and then it's like you've got your North Face jacket on, and you've got your
yeah,
boots in the background.
they're very comfortable. But yeah, if you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's a dark film, but it's as good, I think, as you've heard. And it's actually really interesting because it's one of those things where at the time Francis Ford Coppola kind of gets the gig based on he's this big Italian-American guy, and the feeling is that he'll be able to get the nuances.
100% racist.
Yeah, kind of. And I do believe that they played with ideas of setting it modern day, and that, yeah, there's a big book of the script of The Godfather, which all of Coppola's notes, and then, like, backstory. It's incredible. If you could pick that up and watch The Godfathers, like, that is film school. Do that. It's going to take 6 hours, and you'll learn everything you need to know. But, yeah, art imitating life, life imitating art. This movie comes out, and now the mafia wants to be these guys. And so it starts to get the flip where now you have 20 years of, crime bosses fashioning themselves off of the fiction.
It was like the Tom Clancy novels for them, where, like, a bunch of, like, Russian guys went, oh, wait, that's how the Americans think? That's how the Russians think, and then that, like, Tom Clancy probably made the war worse.
Oh, they're coming out with a Michael B. Jordan's in a new one called whatever.
It's already out. Yeah, no. And it's the beginning of the Rainbow Six series. So
there's,
like,
going to be five more.
Yeah, I just spoiled it.
Well, yeah.
Anyway.
But yeah, so, and The Godfather's also fascinating. It comes out in 72. Obviously, we talked about the Vietnam War some last week. There's a great, you know, protest and backlash to that war. And there's this feeling that you can go at power now. And that's what this movie is about. It kind of shows the corruption of the politicians and the cops with the mob. And, like, they're all kind of complicit. And, I mean, my favorite scene is the one with, I think, Pat McGeary, the senator. And he comes in to see Michael.
In two.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's in two. And, yeah, and he has a proposal. And he's thrown off at first because Michael doesn't dismiss Tom Hagen, which is his attorney. And then, you know, the couple guys standing around, like the bodyguards. And so the politician gets off to a rough start with it, but then he just leans in and he starts on, like, this very powerful, I mean, he's a senator, and he's basically threatening them with liquor licenses that would, like, submarine their operation. And he's trying to bribe $250,000 out of them along with a stake in these casinos. And what plays out is it's a perfect microcosm of those films. And I think you made the great point that it also illustrates how much he is and how much he isn't like his father, all in kind of the scene. And he's sitting in the chair, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No. So the thing about Godfather 1 and 2 is it's about Michael Corleone breaking bad. Because, I mean, when he comes home, he's the war hero. He's the model son. Sonny's going to be the lead. But
yeah,
Sonny
Diane Keaton
very,
is
very
his
big
girlfriend, right? Very, he's
yeah,
shown very
she
innocent.
She is an outsider. She's not Italian.
Right, yes.
You know, he's kind of like, he is not of the family. He's very much like, I am not my father. I am not my family. I am not like them. They are criminals. And he hates it.
And they're fine. They want him in that role, but it, like you said,
yeah,
it breaks
bad. But they
bad.
Also want him out of the business too. You know, but there's this piece of him when there's an attempt on the father's life. You know, everyone's like, you know, we need to back off, and Sonny wants to do it. And then Michael tries to do something and kind of gets laughed off of as like, you punk. Like, you think you could do this? Like, you've been gone for however long? Like, you were in the army and you think, what, you did it? Like, they're like these street guys. To them, like, he's almost like a pretty boy.
Yeah, he's small time.
Like, they don't think of it like, but odds are he killed somebody, at least one person while he was over there. So it's not like he hasn't killed somebody before.
And you can tell in those scenes, and this is why Pacino's a great actor.
You can tell that there is also,
there's something
did stuff in that war that he told no one about. And in that moment, that's when you can see he is like his father. He actually is much closer to his father than Sonny is. Sonny's the one that went off the handle. Really, Sonny should have went in the military.
Yeah,
Sonny would have probably
discipline.
Done better in the military. Yeah, he would have been better under the discipline. That maybe would have like bucked him a little bit. He was a wild stallion.
Yeah, it's a great performance.
Yeah, and but it's also very easy to peg him. Now, the difference with Michael is that he is and isn't a part of the business. Like at the end of The Godfather, Diane Keaton goes, because he gives him a chance. He's like, you can ask me whatever you want right now, and I will 100% tell you the truth. And she asks if so-and-so was killed because of Michael. Or did Michael kill, and says the person. And he says no. And it's true. He didn't. He ordered it. He didn't do anything. He stood there.
And
he watched, but he didn't kill him.
That's so crucial because that is his stance of power.
He is lawful evil. That is a perfect example of lawful evil. And in a lot of ways, you can kind of be like, it almost feels more evil because he's able to like work within these constraints.
It's cognitive dissonance. It's a lie to yourself.
Yeah.
That's like murdering someone and say like, oh, the gun did it.
Or murdering the hooker and saying the senator.
Which, yeah, and again, a power move. He didn't do that. I don't even think he told, like, he just had to nod his head, right? Look at Tom Hagen, and Tom Hagen, the fixer. He'll handle it.
Michael is able to confidently say he doesn't do anything.
Right, it's...
Because all he has to do is nod because he's like, I didn't even say do something.
And that's how these people think. And I mean, the senator is shown as, I mean, he goes to them with the proposition, like, for them, he wants to get in on their business, and he's lucky because he realizes he could be a bulwark in that, and he goes on this racist diatribe, this senator, which is probably what escalates his situation. I'll just say that.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, right? He's looking at them like they're Italian, but the thing that was always pointed out to me,
they're Italian American, right?
No.
Oh,
they're Sicilian American.
Oh, okay.
They're Sicilian. And like all the dialect that they're using in the mafia talk is Sicilian because that's what mafia talk use. Sicilian is one of the hardest dialects of Italian.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's why FBI. Oh, yeah. No, I learned that from like watching all these documentaries and stuff because I was all into it when I was younger. I had this big crime face like crime specials and serial killers and this and that.
Season
two. Yeah, right. So what ended up happening is that they would talk in Sicilian. But a lot of them, like La Cosa Nostra, and all that, like, apparently has like a lot of Sicilian roots. Well, Italians talk about Sicilians that way, that they're less than or whatever, because Sicily is like a giant salt mine. And back in ancient whatever, whoever controlled Sicily had the most salt, which could cure the most food, which meant that they could travel the furthest with their troops. There wasn't refrigeration. There wasn't rations with chemical whatever. Wasn't freeze-dried anything. It was salt.
The Mark Kurlansky book called Salt, my wife's reading it, and it has the most fascinating stories about salt, how like world events around salt.
So in Sicily, like, salt is huge in terms of like cooking and everything, but like all these different cultures came in and would take over. So Sicilians have like all these cultural tags from like the Moorish Empire and the Arabic Empire and this empire.
Well, and think about what the when they go
and that senator is like, what the senator doesn't realize is that he's like triggering him on like two fronts. Not only is he saying you're less than Italian, the Italians sometimes say that he's less than Italian.
Oh wow.
Like, yeah, and the like, and the Corleone family does have to deal with that in some regards because, like, Hagen is an Italian,
right? Yeah, and at, so, that, like, that's why he has to be the
he's
outsider.
He's like the hand of the king.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
You know, yeah, but he's like, that's why he's so good, though. That's why he's there. But he's also able to talk to these outside guys, like
Duval
the senator,
is so
like, listen.
Yeah, to reason
talk
with
to
them.
These guys. Yeah, because he's like, he kind of appeals to the racism. Which is evil. He's kind of like, look, listen, let me talk to these guys. I know their language. You know what I'm saying? Like, he kind of almost says it back to him, and the guy's like, yeah, oh, God, please save me. You're one of the good ones.
Yeah, it,
which
it
is.
Like it's
the
a good
worst
cop,
possible
cop.
Thing.
Would you rather yeah, have the like, mob mad at you or, like,
but
the mob
but it's
lawyer?
All of these things are, like, all evil that they do throughout the whole movie. And like Coppola like tackles evil in a lot of these things. Ends up doing that a lot with Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now is just Heart of Darkness, where he's just tackling the darkness.
Right. Straight up the gut.
Yeah.
Well, and that novel was abound with, you know, imperialistic portrayals, like racist portrayals of locals and stuff. And you do get some of that stuff in Apocalypse Now, but that film was made and it had its own political edge because of it was coming out of the Vietnam War. And so that movie, Coppola, and just a quick note, the conversation he also made in between The Godfathers and Apocalypse
yeah, I'm
Now.
Sorry.
And Gene,
I totally spaced over that. I am so
no,
sorry.
No. This it's fine because it. Yeah, Gene Hackman is wonderful in it, and actually Ridley Scott, who we'll talk about in a minute, his brother Tony Scott directed something of a sequel, which you've probably heard of, is Enemy of the State. So if you've seen that movie and not The Conversation, go back because Gene Hackman's character in Enemy of the State is essentially his character from The Conversation. It's very
I had
interesting.
No idea.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it's really
That's
cool.
Insane.
It's yeah, it's like a stepbrother or something to the film. But yeah,
it's like a spiritual sequel.
In Enemy of the State, obviously, I love that movie. But yeah, it was made on a much bigger budget, modern day, with the biggest star in the world, Will Smith. So. Yeah, that's a good double feature if you catch a rainy Saturday. But yeah, you're gonna need that much time just to watch Apocalypse Now because that is a long movie, and it was a long war.
And I would probably say, don't even bother with the director's cut.
No, watch Redux, the French Riviera scene. I love it. I love it.
I like that scene, but it's not worth the rest of the movie. I think that there's a lot of those scenes where it's like they just feel fat now.
It's the wedding scene in Deer Hunter that everyone was like, you can't have a 40-minute wedding scene of just people dancing. and he kept it in. It's kind of the pulsing heart of that film. But yeah, the fun note, personally, on Apocalypse Now, I was watching it after work one day and a tree fell in my car and I didn't realize it at first because I thought it was the sound effects when in the opening scene when Martin Sheen's like having flashbacks. But I felt the house shake and I was like, I don't think my sound system's that good. And then I went out back, there was a huge tree on a car and I was like, yo, that sucks for that guy. And then I was like, oh, I am that guy. I did later that night finish the movie though, because that it's that good. What would you say about Apocalypse Now? Because it's a movie you've probably seen in bits and pieces if you're like me, and then maybe once or twice sitting down probably in a film class. Like, what resounds with you most?
For me, I think it's how they were able to capture the spirit of Heart of Darkness in that film and transpose it onto the Vietnam War, kind of take the colonialist problems that are with the book and highlight them and make that a problem of the war.
Wow, fantastic way to put it. Yeah, that's what I was reaching for earlier, but I couldn't articulate
like,
it.
I think
like
that's
that.
Why you like the French Riviera scene the most, because it feels the most like this is the byproduct of French colonialism.
Oh, and they just talk about politics straight up in that scene and eat nice food.
Yeah,
and
no,
it's dream-like.
But the problem with that scene, like I like that scene, but I think the problem is like with a lot of the other New Wave films is that's so on the nose.
Okay.
It's so on the nose writing, or it's like it's just so literal and it just feels like this weird moment of clarity in the film like if I take it as a part of the film, it doesn't really fit narratively speaking, like it with the flow of the traditional theatrical cut, just because if that's really that moment of clarity, that was really their chance to turn around, and then they just kind of ignored it and just kept going, and then the movie got more crazy and they basically just ignored that guy.
Well, because
the whole time, like, it kind of feels like they just forgot about him after that. Like, it doesn't really feel a part, and like, for at least for me,
yeah,
at least for me. Like, if there was at least one or two more callbacks, I'd go, no, that movie isn't that, or that movie, that scene is important.
You know what would be,
but
a,
it's not like
a cool thing for us to do pivotal. As a bonus episode is watch that scene and do a commentary or something on it. Because it is,
you know,
it kind of
actually
stands
really like to do.
Alone.
I would love to do an actual like live watching with you. That would be really fun if we could figure out how to do that, where we could like sit down and like film it and watch it and like maybe like put that on our YouTube or something.
That would, okay.
Like, as a super cut.
Well, we both got and, like, shot one of the vaccine in us, right? So we're waiting for the other shoe to drop, and yeah, we can get together. That would be awesome. Yeah, we can.
I think that's a great
start
idea.
Beefing up the YouTube.
Yeah, no, we're totally good to do that. Now, we have two, I don't think they're really drastic edits. I think there's scenes that are a lot longer in the redux, or like they add in, that to me don't really fit as well as in the theatrical cut. Maybe we can talk about that, you know, like I said, later time.
Yeah, it would be cool. Almost like a, yeah. Well, and this shoot was famously.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is this shoot was famously just really a problem, not just because, and we kind of touched on it with the method acting with Brando, that he didn't really read the script and he just kind of.
Well, he was off method. A method actor would have read the script and studied. He just showed up, and apparently was every week he was on set, he was getting $1 million. So he was just balking at every chance to get more money. That could be its own thing. I mean, there is the heart of, the background movie that Coppola's wife made, shooting Coppola and the cast and crew and every. I mean. You were talking about this,
which I actually have not had a chance to see.
It's,
I would love to
it's
see
crazy.
That. I haven't seen that, and I have not seen Room 236 or whatever it's called for the one for The Shining.
The Shining. Yeah, well, that's not very much the same. That's made by people outside the Coppola's wife shot all the footage. But you were saying about the script and how great it is to it parallels with the book it's based on, Heart of Darkness. A lot of that was on the fly because that script, it was evolving. The original ending they couldn't do because it basically involved Brando having to move, and he couldn't do it. He was so overweight on that. Everyone talks about it. There's a great
That's why he's like that, because he physically can't.
He was so big, apparently, at that time. Yeah, they couldn't. The ending they had included him having to do something that he wasn't going to be able to do. He's this big fat guy. Heart of Darkness, guy, he's a big string, the tall, skinny guy. Now, they knew they weren't going to get that with Brando.
He is, like, emaciated. Like, he looks like – if you read the book, which I have. I've read the book. The horror is actually, like, that scene with that line is not actually the ending. The ending is –
with the sacrifice.
The ending is Marlowe comes back. And you got to remember that Marlowe is actually telling this to a crew member on, like, this rinky-dink boat for, like, this fishing thing. Marlowe is, like, kind of stranded amongst the jungle, but kind of like, you know how, like, Rambo is in the last Rambo movie? Not the last one, the second to last one. Not Last Blood, the one that's just called Rambo.
Sure, he's on his
own. Yeah, where he's just like a ferryman in Vietnam. Like, why are you here if this is the place with all your trauma? Like, that's kind of what it's like for Marlowe. And he's telling the story, and then he gets back, and the wife wants to know what happened to the captain, and he lies to her. And he says, his last words were of you. His last thoughts were of you, not the horror. Like, he completely lies. Because he needs to hold on. This woman needs to hold on to the idea that her husband stayed human.
Which was not at all the case.
No, he had completely lapsed into nothing at that point.
And that's got to be what it is. That Heart of Darkness, once that French Riviera scene in the movie couldn't have stopped them. That journey, they were already in the darkness, and it was immovable. It was never going to stop. That was a fixed point. They were
I don't think you needed that scene to like say that. I do agree with the theatrical cut, which is weird for me because I do like a lot of different director's cuts, but just that one just feels
too big. The other big conversation about director's cuts is, I mean, Ridley Scott has a couple of them with the Blade Runner. There's two different endings that completely changed the movie.
But I mean, at this point, it's like Alien at this point, right? Because, I mean, this comes out in 79, Apocalypse Now, doesn't? And Alien comes out in 79.
Yeah, in Apocalypse Now, it was shot in, like, 76, but as we said, it was infamously long process to get that movie out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, this is a really cool juxtaposition of, like, what can happen when it goes right and goes wrong with this auteur theory.
Godfather was all aces. That movie, that's why every actor, everything is perfect. That's the pinnacle of American New Wave auteur.
Yeah, but then you have Apocalypse Now, where everything can go wrong when the wrong personalities are in the room.
You got Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, they were able to.
But the biggest X factor.
The movie did turn out really well. I mean, like you can argue that it turned out very well, especially given what happened. But you have Alien, where Ridley Scott's coming right off of The Duelists with Harvey Keitel, and he gets this script, and it's this monster movie in space, but he's able to do this art house horror thing with it. And they give him a lot of creative control. I mean, he's able to actually truly build the Nostromo one-to-one scale when they're running around that ship.
Like, really?
It looks like that.
That's actual.
Yeah, they were doing scenes. They were doing everything, right? And there's a lot of, just like Heart of Darkness is playing a lot with like the idea of like the further the American soldiers got away from America and from supervision and everything, the worse the war got, because they were kind of just in the jungle just fighting to survive, and the madness of war and the madness of the jungle and the madness of deep, deep isolation from society. Alien kind of has that same thing where, but with the guise of supervision. With Mother, right?
Mother.
And then you have, that's what this onboard ship's called, Mother. And they're always like, Mother, what's going on, Mother? Can you tell us what's going on, Mother? And they're like waiting for Mother to tell them what to do next. Like, it feels like they're being treated like babies. They end up just there on this thing because Mother tells them that they have to go there. That's not even part of their contract, outside of the fact that Weyland-Yutani says, like, whenever there's like a distress beacon, you have to get this thing or you don't get your full pay. Like, there was a chance that they probably didn't have to go, but like it was inferred in their contract with the way that like the legal jargon is that they have to go. The other thing that goes on with that is just how they have the robot kind of installed in there that the
like undercover,
supposed
right?
to be yeah, it was supposed to be found. It was on the flight path. It was all this stuff. Like, it, like, corporate wanted the specimen to come back. They knew what this thing was. There was already other people that had seen this, right? Because they want to be able to mess. Yeah, they want to turn this thing into a weapon because it literally is the perfect weapon. I mean, its blood is a weapon.
Yeah, well.
And, like, it infects soldiers and then rips out of the soldiers and then eats the other soldiers and turns them into fodder to make more of those things. And if they get shot, their blood is acid. Yeah, that sounds like exactly like something a corporation would want to commodify and sell.
It's a weapon.
On the black market.
It's a bioweapon.
Yeah, and this is totally like totally within the theme of the New Wave, right? We've got to stick it to the man. Like, this is what happens when you let the man have control and capitalism takes over and blah, 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 blah. Like, at the very end when Ripley is, like, screaming, she's screaming for Mother to do something, and the ship is, like, just going to blow her up.
Yeah, because it's not a
Mother
human.
But Mother isn't really an AI either. Mother is, like, just a computer program. It's kind of like an idiot. It's not like HAL 3000. It's not that sophisticated. It's not 2001 A Space Odyssey here. It's just whatever the program was for these certain protocols, that's what's happening. And at this point, the ship's on fire and everybody's dead. We just got to blow up the ship.
Well, yeah,
Sorry,
the protocol, it's like algorithms nowadays that they are programmed for a purpose.
It actually operates exactly a lot more like that, where it's like a dumb AI, which is kind of
like
the terminology,
DoorDash.
Right?
Or Uber. DoorDash. No one works at DoorDash.
Yeah, it's just a bunch. I'm sorry. You can have 25-minute pause on your dash while you try to fix your tire. After that, you're fired. I mean, like, that's kind of feels. The other thing that Alien plays with is the idea of, although there's a lot of movies that are with, like, sexual violence against women at this point, like Last House on the Left and, like, that kind of stuff.
Oh, those,
a lot
of
slasher
horror,
flicks.
Yeah, B-movie
exploitation
films.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why the Alien does this to a male character in the script is because the male writer wanted to make white, straight males super uncomfortable, particularly those men that thought rape was a good idea, because he thought it was so abhorrent that no one had been doing, like they weren't to him, like, that was exploitation. It wasn't, look how evil rape is. It was like, this is a sex scene. This is porn. This is disgusting. So his response to that was to make this alien that literally raped the guy's face and impregnated him with something. He gets this pregnancy craving for all this food, oh, yeah. And then it rips out of him and he dies in childbirth by some weird penis monster.
Wow. That's
why it's so crazy.
So
the scene where the baby is born, where the alien baby's born, they didn't know that was the scene in the script. It was a different scene when he was alone. And he took that out and said, no, it's now. And suited him up and everything. And then they had the thing. And that's why they act like that and have that look. And that's like the best acting all those people had done for like a look, because they were literally that scared.
Wow, that's a great.
They thought he was dying. And when they got sprayed with blood and that woman screamed, she really thought that was blood.
See, I love hearing these stories, and they sound awesome when the movie's great, but it's like, how much of that is traumatic? Like, when...
Oh, yeah, no, some of these people didn't work anymore.
When DiCaprio supposedly cut his hand and then started slapping people to stay in character.
Oh, not supposedly, no, that totally did happen, he did that.
What we talked about with method going too far, and these directors...
You know what? This was fake. It wasn't real blood. It was fake blood.
I just always think it's funny when it, like, Hitchcock actually did this to the, it's like, oh, that sounds creepy. But this is way different.
Well, you know what? It's not that much different. I don't know. I mean, like, well, I guess it's partly different because, at least for me, I felt like it was partly different because at the end there's a Muppet.
Yeah. At least, yeah.
It's like, surprise!
And that, I mean, that is one of the most shocking. Like, it's incredibly painful to watch. Incredibly painful. Yeah. And I wasn't even realizing
the point.
All that male.
It's meant for you and me to feel uncomfortable.
Right. For us to.
It's meant for us to feel bad about it, because he wanted us to feel the way those women felt when they watched Last House on the Left. Like, that was an intentional decision. That's what I'm talking about when I say, like, an auteur needs to make those intentional decisions.
Well, and you just, that was originally written for a male, right? The Sigourney Weaver part is...
Yeah. No, Ridley Scott decided to make that a female and not change anything in the script and just keep it, like, with the son of a... Got weed whackers. Weed whacking landscapers for my townhouse. 1 second, I'll be right back.
That's how they told us in health class to say no to marijuana. It was like, weed's for whacking, grass is for cutting, not for smoking.
Is that why you ended up just using it? You're just like, well, let me see what happens.
Yeah, it's a long-term experiment.
Maybe you're like, well, whacking seems fun. My dad says I should stop whacking sometimes.
So, Ripley was originally a man, and they had cast a male. There's actually, photos of, like, test shots and whatever, and wardrobe of the male. And Ridley Scott thought, like, well, when he read the script, he was like, well, if this is supposed to be doing that, why shouldn't the female be the person that survives?
That
made a lot more sense to him. And so she's able to be like that, but she's also kind of androgynous. Which was very forward thinking for a female lead, and you don't really know. Like, if you go in, like, you have to remember, you have to go in with the expectation that no one knows Ripley's going to survive. No one's even expecting Ripley to survive.
Except you now. If you've never seen it, we just spoiled it for you. Sorry.
It's too late. The whole series is based around her. Of course she survived.
That's true, yeah.
But that was actually kind of quite against the grain. So, I mean, like, and also that movie is shot like an artsy movie.
It
feels like there's a gravitas to
it's
that
an
film
art house
visually
sci-fi
art house horror
house.
It's fantastic
genre blend.
That's why it looks so good. That's why it holds up so well. That's why when you
to this day
it's fantastic.
Oh my, it looks so good.
90% of it is the lighting and the art design.
The Geiger stuff you're talking, the art. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, that's just not just that, but the fact that the physical set is literally the ship. Like they were on that ship and really like deep in it in that method kind of way, that Cassavetti kind of way.
Camaraderie. I mean, what alien are they on now? Prometheus was
No, Alien Covenant was the last one. They are developing a TV series on FX. There are plans to do a different one. If people had gone to see the films, it would have been, like, if Prometheus had been much more successful, it would have been Prometheus, Alien Covenant, and then one other one that would have linked everything together to Alien, and really it was the story of David.
Oh, okay. You
know, it's really more about that android. And at this point in the universe, is Blade Runner and Alien are, like, in the same cinematic universe for Ridley Scott.
Interesting.
So what happens is the Tyrell Corporation eventually basically gets bought out by Weyland-Yutani. Because Weyland Corp and Yutani Industries are different initially. And then Weyland buys out Yutani. And then, but at that point, Weyland had also already bought out the Tyrell Corporation. So they mass producing replicants, and their flagship model was David.
So yeah, that's incredible.
For the Weyland Corp, yeah.
And I wonder when...
he's like literally like... So David and Ash for like... So let's just get back to the original Alien. Ash is legitimately like...
Is that William Devine's character? Is that who that is?
Yes, yes. Yes, he's fantastic. And there's some there's actually, if you watch it again, there's some tells, physical tells. Like, it has this programming of, like, it has this certain protocol. It can, like, if what's, like the mission is more important than the crew, or, like, da-da-da-da-da, and they can just program it whatever certain way they want. But if they get found out, they kind of, like, go crazy.
Because
it's like, well, now I don't have to pretend I'm a person anymore.
They gain in consciousness, essentially, right? Like,
oh, no, they do. But I mean, like, with Prometheus, you see it with David, because, like, he gets obsessed with Lawrence of Arabia. And these are the things that, like, these visual cues that Ridley Scott keeps coming to. So you have, I know we just went on this giant tangent about Alien and Apocalypse Now and Godfather, right? For the crashing of the wave. We kind of have one in one, right? Where it's like, you have a pretty, like, a little over budget, but pretty successful, pretty decent turnout for Alien. You've got a great
for Alien, yeah,
movie, Academy movie for Apocalypse Now, but it was a pretty troubled production. It took a really long time. It went very over budget. It was a big gamble, and arguably they still lost money on it. You know, I mean, like, Coppola still was, like, semi blacklisted for a while because of that movie, because it was the money was so mismanaged. No one wanted to give him that kind of money again. Because what happens if we don't have the movie for 10 years and it's trash? Like, that was the gamble, and they looked to someone else and do that gamble one more time.
You're talking about Michael Cimino here.
Oh, yeah.
The f-
Why don't we... Why doesn't St. Pete take a step back here as we talk about Heaven's Gate?
Okay.
I'm going to let you take the wheel, okay?
So,
I'm going to let Jesus over here take the wheel.
Right. So, yeah... Michael Cimino, he is this very interesting character. Clint Eastwood, actually, is who gives Michael Cimino his start. Cimino wrote a screenplay for Magnum Force, which is the second Dirty Harry movie. And Clint Eastwood took a liking to this guy and offered him to direct the next film that Eastwood was going to do with his production company. And that was Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, which is like this, it's kind of a goofy buddy comedy road movie with Jeff Bridges playing across from Clint Eastwood. And it was a surprise hit at the time, 1974. It was, like we said, this is still the new wave. This is before it broke. So Cimino was now cementing his status as one of these, like, younger hot shots. Now, he's interesting because he went to school for art and painting. He was not at all versed in cinema. And so when he makes Deer Hunter in 78, which we talked about last week, I love the movie, but it's so problematic. You have this incredible quote.
Yeah, so what makes it problematic?
The depiction of, so there were no recorded forced Russian roulette tournaments in the war. There was... That was something that was made up. Now, it's great storytelling. They're, like, some of the most intense scenes you could ever watch. But they're kind of made up, and it kind of told this lie about the war. Because you don't really have to be of a certain politics. Like, historians pretty much agree that the Vietnam War was a failure. We lost, and we shouldn't have gone, and we did. And so we're the invaders there. And so when you go from you cut from this joyous wedding and De Niro and all these guys having the time of their life because they know they're about to go off to war, then you cut right to these Vietnamese men screaming in their ear and spinning a gun and telling them, you know, time to play Russian roulette. It That's what led Peter Biskin to call him. He said it's America's Leni Riefenstahl, who we talked about. That was Hitler's filmmaker. He called him our first homegrown fascist. This is the guy who wrote Raging Bull.
And both of them sound like pastries from Delaware County. Oh, look, Larry, they have the salted caramel Riefenstahls. You gotta get a dozen of the salted caramel Riefenstahls.
Yeah, like a taste. Yeah,
all right, but we gotta get the dozen of the mince aminos, or my mother's gonna be so mad. Every time we come here, we don't get the mince aminos.
Don't forget you the Riefenstahls.
For your mother, Larry. So who are you married to? Are you married to me or your mother? Don't get so loud in the picture. I'll get as loud as I want, whatever I want. Don't get so dramatic.
You son of a...
So yeah, when it's presented as it was in that film, it just, I don't know. It was a time when people, it was 78, so they were trying to look back at this war and kind of rationalize it and come to terms with, like, yeah, it was protested the whole time, and now we need to, like, move on for it. And you get this movie, and it kind of reignites this fire because it has, yeah, it has these Vietnamese soldiers playing war games with the Americans, but our presence in their country was, like a war crime. All the bombing we did. Like, all the lives that are still taken to this day because of birth defects and cancers and dirty water. You know, that got left out of the film. And so Deer Hunter tells this great American story about these, you know, hard-working blue-collar guys that go over and have their lives upended by the war. And it's like, that's fine. Why were we there? Why were we there? We shouldn't have been. And to make this movie seem as sympathetic to the American view of the war, that we were just going in and that it was just these savages that were just doing godless things, that was the American, like, we were the ones on the side of, like, massacres. We were the invaders of their country. And so yeah, I as great as this movie is as a narrative, filmically it's wonderful to look at. It is absolutely, it's misleading. Yeah, you got to take a huge dose of history after you watch a movie like that, because it'll get you down the wrong path. And John Pilger has this great quote about the movie, and I think it sums it up pretty much perfectly, because and if you don't know, John Pilger was like a great documentarian and journalist from the Vietnamese War era and Vietnam War era. And on. And he said, nothing changes, it seems. This is how Hollywood created, like, the myth of the Wild West. He goes on to say that the same cynical myth-making is now being applied to the most documented war in history, and that a cheap money-spinning travesty of a movie is being earnestly debated induces more melancholy than anger in those like myself who saw whole Vietnamese communities used as guinea pigs for the testing of a range of anti-personnel military technology, and who saw demoralized, brutalized, and often mutinous American teenagers lying in their own blood and excrement for the purpose of some pointless, sacrificial siege staged in the cause of nothing except for the gratification of inept brass in their air-conditioned offices. So that's what Pilger thought about Deer Hunter.
Yeah, and it actually just came out, like, a couple years ago that Nixon actually got some letters where they tried to do some peace treaties, and he could have, like, ended the war, and he didn't want to. He just, like, ignored it.
Oh, yeah, for re-election.
Yeah, because he wanted to win re-election, yeah, so he ignored it. But, like, I think that actually, if he would have ended the war during the campaign, he probably would have been re-elected. Idiot. Like...
yeah,
he's tricky dick. Maybe I should, you know, do something where they would vote for me. I'll do that, and I'll make tricky. Pot legal, and then, yeah, I'll just buy them.
That's what he should have done, because he's trying to do that with everyone else. Piece of shit.
Yeah, well, his sequel in the 80s is Ronald Reagan, and so we'll get to him next week.
Yeah, and then Donald Trump the is the Godfather Part 3 of that trilogy.
Oh, my God, that is an excellent point that I... The hate happened. So, yeah, after Deer Hunter, we get Heaven's Gate, which at this point, Cimino, he won an Oscar. He's got the best picture, and he's got basically the studio that's backing him, United Artists, for this grand vision of his, Heaven's Gate. It's about, like, the American West and frontier, and I don't know. It's impossible to watch. Don't try. It sucks, and it killed United Artists, which is the company we talked about. It was the independent company that Charlie Chaplin and Mary Pickford started to fight, like, Thomas Edison in the mid-1910s. Yeah, and it took some shithead like Michael Cimino to come along and go way over budget with all this just extravagant bullshit. For this movie.
Yeah, because it was $37 million or something, right, that it did?
It bombed. Yeah, it went way, way past when it was supposed to be finished. And immediately after, United Artists lost so much money, they had to sell themselves off to, I think, MGM or, however that stuff gets consolidated. But
so for someone like me, who has completely avoided that piece of his whole life.
Yes.
can you, I'll be the vehicle for the audience. What's this movie about?
Of Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate. It's hard to say. It goes all over. It has, oh my God, there's this long ass dance scene of like people doing like this turn of the century waltz at like Yale or something. And I don't know. It's just like this stuck up, and then they start like adventuring west. And I mean, Mickey Rourke shows up at some point. Sam Wooderson's in this. There's Christopher Walken.
So there's no plot.
I forget.
There's rumors. Are there rumors of a plot?
There's like an urban legend that
there might be a plot to Heaven's Gate, like just out there, just like the Jersey Devil has the first draft.
Well, actually, it's funny you mentioned that because apparently the Deer Hunter script. Yeah. Which, so to jump back to that quick, Michael Cimino hired someone to write the script and then fired him when he got it and took the credit. And that guy luckily got his credit back, and he ended up with Cut of the Oscar.
That's insane.
But yeah, this is Cimino is. And Heaven's Gate's so bad, killed United Artists, right? Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford rolling in their graves. He gets fired from Footloose. He couldn't get a job until he gets hired as a favor on Footloose. And he wanted to make like handcrafted sets designs, or I don't know. It's a movie about dancing being illegal in a small town, and Kevin Bacon has to like, I don't know, be flamboyant and find freedom. I like, how did he get fired from Footloose?
How dare you speak well of Kevin Bacon during this? Don't bring him into this. That man is a national treasure.
I explain to me why. I never understood Kevin Bacon.
His last
he's
name
got a scrunched up face, like
one of the best
like,
meats on the planet.
And he kind of looks like it, a little scrunched up, like you put it on the frying pan a little bit and it gets scrunched.
And Dustin Hoffman looks like Leonardo DiCaprio.
No, I'm... What are we fighting? We're fighting our Hollywood
actors. No, he's not like my idol.
Like Bob.
No, he's not my idol. Like, it's just...
I would lay down my sword for Hoffman.
I just feel like he's aligned a lot more with the city of Philadelphia than you think he is. He's like a John Bon Jovi kind of guy. Like, I don't necessarily listen to Bon Jovi's music. I can barely say his name during the sentence. But, like, I'm supportive of the man.
That music's terrible.
I'm supportive of the man and what he does for our city. It's good for him. You know what? Anyone that brings in stuff to
the football championship with the soul before the Eagles got it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, you know, because kind of like how we found a niche in film history podcasts. He's like, why compete with the NFL when I can just do arena football?
It's indoor. It's easy.
You know, why try to compete with
well, it's
Joe
not
Budden?
Easy. It's...
I don't need to compete with Joe Budden's podcast. He's got his own thing going on. He's amazing.
Pump it up.
Yeah, well, Slaughterhouse is dope, but I'm a Royce guy.
Royce to 5'9"
out of all of them. So yeah, hell yeah, that new record of his from I guess last year is dope. Nice. He made the beats on his phone.
Ooh.
It's awesome. Yeah, what isn't awesome is that so Michael Cimino, in addition to just being such an awful person, he get fired from Footloose. His dream project was to make like the Ayn Rand, the Fountainhead. Or Atlas Shrugged into a film.
Yeah, but that's
and,
also
like,
Zack Snyder's
too. It's a trash worldview held by people who have hatred in their hearts. Objectivism is, it's solipsism. It's no one else matters except you. It just justifies whatever anyone wants to do in the name of like progress, but not real progress. She was a fascist. And Cimino, the more I read about him,
it's rugged individualism.
I don't like him.
Rugged individualistic, like Ubermenschian bullshit.
Yeah, I just mentioned that Pilger quote with the myth of the American West, which was chock full of that rugged individualist projection. And it's not really how things are. And Ayn Rand, I'm glad he never got to make those movies. But what he tried writing them with James Toback, who we might remember as the guy who recently has had 300 women, over 300 women, come out and accuse him of sexual assault. And just a quick side note, if you ever want to hear Alec Baldwin get schooled, listen to the New York Times reporters who broke the Weinstein story. Their names are Jody Cantor and Megan Tui. And they take Baldwin to task on his own podcast about his friendship with Toback. In addition to that, Baldwin comes out and trying to defend himself, and he says how he knew about Weinstein before a lot of people. And they kind of take him to task on that. It's a fascinating interview, and hats off to those girls.
Wait a second. I knew about Weinstein before anybody else, and I said nothing. Is that what he said, basically?
I mean, it wasn't like a secret, but like Alec Baldwin has like worked closely with him, and James Toback, like he has these like skeezer friends, and I don't like Alec Baldwin. I'm tired of him. Bring them down, Jody Cantor and Megan Tui, because his best friend was James Toback, and I just don't believe he wasn't around for even one of those 300 sexual assaults. So Michael Cimino, this is like his crowd. Mickey Rourke is one of his frequent collaborators. He almost got De Niro killed in Deer Hunter with this reckless helicopter stunt.
Oh my God.
And so, yeah, this guy, he just, the more I was reading about, when he was making Deer Hunter, he was going around telling everyone he was a medic for the Green Berets, which could not be verified, is almost certainly a lie. And the best they could find was that in 62, he did 6 months of Army Reserve. But he made it sound like he was in Vietnam. He signed up after the Tet Offensive, and he went over to be a Green Beret medic.
L. Ron Hubbard did that. He had this supposed military career that he would tell people, but he had you own a boat.
Megalomaniacal liar. Like, they said, people, I forget who it was, but one of his producers said, yeah, Michael Cimino's a pathological liar. He said the only flaw with his Deer Hunter Oscar is that Michael Cimino's name is on it.
Okay, so
this guy is not well liked. I just don't like him when I read about him.
We have Coppola. We have
who's a madman,
but like produces great art and is a wonderful person. And you have Ridley Scott, who produces great art and is a wonderful person and goes over budget. But when he goes over budget, it's for a good reason. And he seems to always there's always a payoff.
He's a guy who has like one of the few kind of blank checks with studios left. Yeah. I forget who his studio is, but like he has such respect. I mean, think of his like he went through a religious epic phase and they let him go.
Kingdom of Heaven bombed terribly, but I mean, he was still able to get enough goodwill to do Prometheus.
I think there was another one recently, right? With Christian Bale, Exodus.
Yes.
The story of and there might even be a third in there. So he gets money and he's reliable. And what he represented is what, like with Spielberg, with Jaws, right? Which is in the mid 70s. Yeah. This is before you get your Heaven's Gate, which kind of just closed the door of this American new wave, because the studios are like, okay, we're not giving you guys free reign. There was some good payoffs early, but it's not worth it as you guys get more and more insane.
Cimino was the guy that went on SNL and improved at the wrong time.
Right, yeah, and got the ire. Way.
And Lauren Michaels went, I will never let improv on this show again.
You'll never work in this town. Yeah, that kind of, like, he was, I mean, Cimino was kind of blacklisted, and then he washed up in the mid-80s. Yeah. He worked with, like, Oliver Stone to get this Mickey Rourke movie made. He fizzled out. He was like this wunderkind supposed to be, and he wasn't. Cimino wasn't. Now, Spielberg was a wunderkind, and he turned out. But what he did early was that on Jaws, he was like this sober-headed sea captain on that film, because apparently that was a pretty tumultuous shoot. Nothing like Apocalypse Now, because, they had like real disasters on their hands in Apocalypse Now and tsunamis and stuff. And had to deal with the military. Jaws was just like, they couldn't get the shark to work and all this other stuff. But he was able to see that movie through. It's a perfect film. Go watch Jaws. You can hit freeze at any point, and the screen is beautiful. It's a wonderful movie. But what it did, like, it is an art movie, right? It's an art house take on, a disaster. It's kind of like a kaiju movie.
Like Gojira.
Oh, yes. Except, we're coming from under the water in the summer where everyone is instead of, in the city. That's a a great point.
But it has a very Moby Dick feel too. It has that classical like kind of root in Moby Dick, especially that sea captain who's very much like a Captain Ahab. But it has that feel to it. But it also feels like a monster movie like Godzilla or like Mothra or something like that. Like, it's a genre film, much in the same way that Alien is a genre film. But these guys were taking those 50s and 60s genre things and those tropes and going, what if we gave them a little bit more respect? And what if we treated them with the gravitas of like a classical novel or like or a historical epic or something like that? And that's how you get Alien, and that's how you kind of get Jaws.
John Carpenter's The Thing comes at with this.
Well, The Thing is later.
82?
Yeah, The Thing comes out after E.T., and that's kind of the reason why it doesn't. If it would have came out before E.T., it probably would have been much more successful.
Oh, really? Okay, we're going to have to hit that next week when we talk the 80s, because Spielberg is... He's not going to go away, folks. He's still making great movies with studios. But yeah, so apparently he wasn't like a big smoker or drinker, right? All the rest of this kind of class was, and they were wild. And the stories were wild, but the movies were even crazier and better, right? And they would work and they would sell. And it just ran short. Right. And so, but a guy like Spielberg, he can see the ship through and then go to the studio and say, okay, let's do another one. And then he cranks out Close Encounters. And then, yeah, you get E.T. a couple years later. He knows how to make these big budget movies. He can work with the studio. He ends up making his own studios, right? You get DreamWorks, and he has his own part of Hollywood's his. Like, same with Francis Ford Coppola. They were able to get their own cutouts. Michael Cimino never got that. He looked like he could have had it, and he blew it. Yes, he's... yeah, we are glad he did not get it.
Everyone fits on Joel Schumacher for the bat nipples thing. Everyone should... on Cimino like this. Give Joel Schumacher a break. You know, like Falling Down is a great example of what happens with unchecked white male rage in corporate America.
That's a fantastic point.
And great acting from Michael Douglas. Great acting from we were just talking about him from The Godfather. Oh my God.
Oh, Robert Duvall.
I can't believe I forgot his name. I'm so sorry.
The police officer, right?
This is my
Who wants to get home to his wife.
yeah, no, and he's trying to stop him on the dock, you know.
Oh, that end scene with his son's birthday and his wife.
Wait, I'm the bad guy? And he has that realization that he's the monster? Like, that's a really great scene. That's really, really great.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that,
realization Cimino never made, apparently, because...
No, not once.
No one liked working with him.
Not once. The end of his life. Actually, the way you talk about Deer Hunter, it feels like James Cameron's Alien kind of takes some notes from Deer Hunter. It is a very like ultra American viewpoint of like Vietnam. Because like if Alien is a haunted house in space, then Aliens is like a Vietnam movie in space. Where like Hamburger Hill. It's like Full Metal Jacket. There is like a little bit of the anti-American stuff in it, but it's more like. It's these guys in corporate that are making it bad. It's these particular individuals that are making it bad. If we have the right guys
and
in
there's
place,
more
it'll work. Like
battles and oorah, the Marine aspect, right? Like they're out doing missions.
The guy who survives, the guy who comes in and saves everybody is the real tough-ass, cool Marine. You know, like Kyle Reese is there, man. Like that's his buddy. That's Kyle Reese from Terminator. It's the same actor.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Okay.
And he's literally just Kyle Reese again. But we'll get into that next week, too, especially with, like, Star Wars and all that. But, like, really, Spielberg is the one that's going to start bringing in these guys. And really, this helps fuel corporate. This helps fuel,
Jaws being such a huge hit.
Going, look.
Summer blockbuster, families are going to see it. It was like, once they made it, they looked at it and they said, we can recreate this. And, like, how didn't we come onto this before? But it was now, like, it just felt like you had this whole demographic of families that would now go watch a movie, you know, PG-13. But it had all the thrills and excitement of what the adult would want to see. And it you know, kids see it and don't go in the ocean for the rest of their lives like me.
No, I don't think any children should have seen that. I don't think any children should have.
Eight and up. I think an 8-year-old can see Jaws now.
That's... No, I wouldn't let... I would never let... No.
How old do you have to be to watch the... Nature Channel to watch gazelles get eaten by lions, and I mean, they show that stuff
in
class.
It's not but I wouldn't show that to my kid anyway. I don't feel comfortable watching that. Like, it's hard enough looking at the Nature is Metal Reddit sometimes.
True. Okay.
it's like some of that. I'm like, oh my God, how did that snake get inside that skull, out, and then back in again?
How would you recut Jaws as a kids movie? It's a rubber ducky.
Oh God, no! I don't know. No, I couldn't do that. There's no way. There's no way you could do that. No, I think I think Close Encounters is much better for an 8-year-old to see. Music as a language, mashed potato awesome. Sculpting. The best, it's much better for a whole family.
The best thing I've ever heard about Spielberg, and I cannot remember this quote, but I remember reading it years ago in a magazine. They said he makes kids movies for adults and adult movies for kids. And
that is 100%
true. I can never unthink that, because he has Jaws, like you said, it does. It's a horrifying movie, but it does have like this innocence, like you said, this American sheen. I mean, they shoot Roy Scheider.
Actually, that was
his family, like lovingly.
It has a Western appeal with the classical thing, but the American sheen, that's all you, baby. That's not me.
Oh, okay. Sweet. Yeah, I think they're harkening back a lot of those early scenes. You know, you get Scheider and his kids and family, and they're trying to show like a modern family that's like close knit, but you know, they have all the problems. And Spielberg loves like little rapscallion kid characters, right? I mean, E.T. is full of them. He produces Goonies, which is like basically a spinoff.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he has this wonderful sense. I mean, we talked about Hook. We'll get in that in a couple of weeks. But yeah, he just has this great knack for it. But Jaws gets that start. And with Jaws, that opens the lane for his buddy, George Lucas, right? Yeah. A couple of summers later.
Yeah, with Star Wars. We are recording this on May the 4th. By the time this comes out, it'll be May the 6th. We're not going to do a big whole Star Wars spiel. And Mark has heard enough from me today about Star Wars stuff. but what these guys do with Spielberg and Lucas is that these are the guys that the corporate business people just really come in with this. This is really once the wave crashes, they're going, okay, what do we do now? And it kind of turns into like the blockbuster summer era. We start having like movie summers. But with like Spielberg and Lucas, what you have is them going, look at what we can do with these guys. Now, Lucas wasn't necessarily a corporate guy. Like, he was kind of bucking the trend. But what he had created was very much something that corporate actually wanted. Where Spielberg was good at creating products that they wanted, right? Where they were asking for these particular things.
And park rides, too.
Sort of, it feels like that. And he is able to play ball. And he's sober. You know, like, that's a big boon for him. And, like, with this wave crashing, I mean, the whole, like, drug culture is kind of crashing down, too. Particularly the psychedelic culture, where people kind of didn't find answers at the end of that road. A lot of those people sobered up. The Beatles sobered up by this point. They were like, oh, wait, no, this is just like this weird like end of the road, and there's nothing after this. It's just this forever. Then that's not an answer. And there was this kind of, I feel like, reckoning of like, who are we and what are we supposed to do with our lives? Like, what are we supposed to do now when the party's over and stuff? And that happens a lot with the new wave. And it really comes crashing down for these filmmakers, and it comes crashing down in terms of the business. Because when you have Heaven's Gate losing $37 million and destroying United Artists, that is a huge thing. That's like a .com level bursting level thing for those business guys. They're like, this is an institution that has been destroyed by one crazy ass lunatic who did too many drugs and drank too much and was an asshole
and let it all go to his head. Yeah, they say he was like a tyrant on set. He's one of those guys.
Yeah, so where do we go from here? And you find someone like Spielberg coming up going, here I am. And then Lucas does have he's not as bad as someone like Kubrick, but he does dig his heels in. But what he had was this knack of going, no, you don't understand. I'm making exactly what you want.
You just don't understand.
Yeah. And when they didn't see certain things, like the toy sales and stuff like that, and he was the one that was going for it or making the special effects companies and stuff, and everyone thought he was crazy. Like, no, you don't understand. This is what you want. You want Flash Gordon. You just don't understand it yet. And that's kind of what he was doing. He was remaking Flash Gordon with Star Wars. And then these, like, kind of auteur guys go to the side for a little bit. And if they do come up, it's more in the sense of, like, a brand. You know, like Coppola becomes a brand. Spielberg becomes a brand. Lucas becomes a brand. Scorsese becomes a brand.
There was a class that didn't make it.
Yeah, and a lot of them were.
And
like
they were relegated.
They were the ones that got lost in it. That kind of.
Hal Ashby's one of those guys.
That lost the point. Great they example. Thought it was about that particular content, or it was like the drugs are the thing that are getting me there. The drinking is the thing that's getting me there. Or the whatever's getting me there. The acid.
Yeah. Like. Dennis Hopper's a great example. In the 80s, he sobered up and kind of became this like older generation of like actor. And I mean, he played a lot of villains and stuff.
Like, he kind of survived this era because there's a lot of people that didn't make it. There's a lot of people that didn't make it. And like were lessons for people.
It's a great point.
And that's kind of the problem with waves. Like when there's this big push and this big movement and there's all this power and this fever, right? It crashes. It always crashes. Every wave crashes into the rocks, into the to the beach, into whatever, and settles out. And you kind of got to know when to surf. And if you can't figure that out, you're never going to be able to be successful in any art form that you do, or really in life. You have to figure out when this wave is coming and going, or you know you're going to get left behind by the other surfers are going to get ahead of you, and you're going to be lost in the middle of the water, or you're going to be like in the froth and foam.
And that's where Bruce, the animatronic shark from Jaws, lives. You don't want to get left behind.
Yeah,
no. Oh no! It's so rusty! It's so rusty!
I gotta get my shots.
I just got my COVID shot. I didn't know I needed tetanus. Why did I fly Frontier? That was the first mistake.